Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the head office of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Welcome friends, comrades, visitors, and the BBC. I just want to say a few words about the Socialist Party of Great Britain. We're the second oldest political party in this country. We were formed in 1904. And this year, we are contesting 10 constituencies at the general election on Thursday, the 7th of May. And this is the largest UK parliamentary campaign undertaken by the Socialist Party since its first as a candidate in the historic 1945 general election. We have been contesting local elections since 1906. The Socialist Party offers the only alternative to the profit system. We stand for the common ownership and democratic control of the resources of the world. Production just for use where goods and services are provided to meet people's needs, not for sale on the market or for profit. Rather than the daily struggle to most people face today, we would have a world where we all have access to what we require to satisfy our needs and are not rationed by the size of our wage packet or state handout. Standing 10 candidates in 10 constituencies means people will have more chance to register their support for a genuine socialist alternative to the capitalist system, one where everybody has an equal say in the way things are run. The Socialist Party stands for a future that works, with everyone able to sit in the driving seat. And we also advocate the revolutionary use of Parliament. It is the Socialist Party's position that Parliament can and should be used in the course of establishing socialism. This position is based on our understanding that before socialism can be established, there has to be a majority in favour of socialism, and that it is essential for this majority to win control over the machinery of government, the state, before establishing socialism. It is control of Parliament that is the way to the control of the machinery of government. Now, since control of Parliament is obtained via elections based on universal suffrage, a socialist majority can win control of the machinery of government through winning a parliamentary majority via the ballot box. I mean, we are the majority. There are more of us than the capitalist class. 99% and 1% is very commonly used today. So we possess the numerical strength to outvote the capitalists at elections. Just to paraphrase Engels, the utilisation of universal suffrage, the vote, is the new method of working people's struggle against capitalism. People and their collective power waste their vote by continuing to vote for MPs of pro-capitalist parties. We say, stop handing over power to capitalist parties and think for yourself as a class for itself and vote socialist delegates into Parliament. It is essential to win control of the machinery of government because the state in class society is the institution with the power to employ socially sanctioned physical force. The state is an expression and enforcer of class society. So by being the majority and taking control of the state via elections and parliament, we can neutralise the state. The decisive control of the state is won politically by us, the people, the working people. We that create the wealth in society. Then the machinery of government and the coercive apparatus of the state can be converted from an instrument of oppression into an agent of emancipation. Elected socialist MPs will be mandated and recallable delegates, replacing the unaccountable professional politicians. Delegates, unlike representatives, are subject to recall. A delegate democracy is in contrast with representative democracy, such as Parliament. It is a distinction between accountable and non-accountable representatives. Socialist-minded workers select one of their number to stand as a candidate to go to Parliament as a socialist delegate. And such delegates are pledged to take instructions from socialists voting for them, organised in the Socialist Political Party, of which we are the embryo. The socialist delegate is backed up and accountable to socialists outside of Parliament. Our prospective socialist candidates, we have four in the room today. We've got Jacqueline Schrodinger, who's standing in Brighton, Bill Martin, who's standing in Islington North, Brian Johnson in Swansea West, Steve Colborne in Easington, Kevin Parkin in Oxford East, Mike Foster in Oxford West and Abingdon, and Robert Cox in Canterbury, Andy Thomas in Folkestone and Hythe, Howard Pilot in Brighton Pavilion. I just wanted to add, though, we are an unusual political party, because once political power has been captured by the socialist movement, the task of the Socialist Party of Great Britain will be at an end. We see no role for the state and government in a socialist society, and as political parties are but the expression of class interests, we, the Socialist Party of Great Britain, stands for its own non-existence as its prime objective. So this is about winning the battle of democracy. So to present the Socialist Party case, our candidate Danny Lambert for Vauxhall will now speak.
Thank you very much.
Well, I was told by a member a few years ago the best way to go about making a speech was to have an introduction, 3 points and a conclusion. So here, by way of an introduction, is this. On our Facebook page, Socialist Party's Facebook page, a week or two ago, I was contacted by a French student doing a PhD thesis on socialist parties in Britain. And we arranged to have its interview over Skype. And I'd set aside around about half an hour for this interview, and an hour and three quarters later, it was still going on. And I was asked all sorts of questions about the party, and we were the Socialist Party were the last on the list. So, as Robert Burns said, it's a great gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us. I asked him what what he thought of the party, and what perhaps if he'd asked the questions, what the other. Because he asked me what I thought of the other socialist parties, the so-called socialist parties in Britain. So I asked him what they thought of us. And he said they thought that we were essentially naive. So then I asked him what he thought. And he said, well, the difference between you, the Socialist Party, and the rest is that where they concentrate on tactics, you concentrate on consciousness, awareness, understanding. Which I think came from the point that I made that you can't have socialism without socialists. So, in that vein, I'd like to put forward what I've discovered while being in contact with the Socialist Party, what I've discovered and what I understand. Well, first, we live in a class-divided society by those. We've got a small, tiny group of those who own and don't produce, and the larger group, the majority, who produce but do not own. And what makes the socialists, what the question socialists ask and what brings them to socialism is, why are the poor poor? And the poor are poor, the answer is simple. The poor are poor because they don't own the means of production. The rich are rich because they do. Now, if we look at the means of production, they have been, all of it, have been socially, collectively developed throughout our history by all human beings. So therefore, it seems only logical to me that if they have been developed collectively and socially throughout our history by human beings, then they should be socially owned and socially controlled for the benefit of human beings. Seems only right. So therefore, there's this denial of ability. And if we look closer, we find that at the core of capitalism, there is a malignancy. And it's this. It is the denial of the first principle of humanity. And this is the natural and industrial resources of our planet are the common heritage of all humans. How could that be otherwise? How could it be otherwise? It strikes me as being totally insane that this is the kind of society we live in. It's a mad society. And what we do when we deny this first principle of our humanity, we deny our own humanity, we deny our own common heritage. We don't deny our own common potential as human beings. Now, that's something about how we live. Well, how might we live? Well, I mean, this insanity goes into the production of our daily life. Now, I spent my whole working life as a builder, and I worked on piecework. So we were always looking to do things easier, quicker, with less labour. Obviously, it's to efficiency. But if we put capitalism to that test, we can see it's totally insane. Because before the whole thing about capitalism, it's an exchange society. It demands the circulation of money. It's commercial, and this throws up consequences. In a capitalist society, we need banking, insurance, taxation, advertising, money lending, debt collecting. We have to have, because it's a private property society, we have to have the law. Now, someone said that property accounts for 9/10 of the law. It certainly accounts for 9/10 of the lawyers. And then we have to have prisons, prison officers. Then there's armies, navies, air forces, military industrial complex. And they've got weights and measures, trade and standards, customs and excise. The list goes on. Now, what all this endeavour has in common that is absolutely essential for capitalism, it produces not one stick of usable wealth. And it absorbs the majority of social effort. It's stunningly, stunningly ridiculous when you look at it. Now, if, on the other hand, we produce solely for use, then all that effort absorbed in, like, reproducing the money system would be available
We're producing what human beings need, what gives us a fulfilling life. And we could do that, unlike in capitalism, which demands that the only thing important is the bottom line. We could therefore go to nature, where the wealth is, in harmony with nature, to provide these goods and services. And with, you know, instead of, say, like, I mean, with this huge, huge increase in the social creativity available, nobody, I can't see anybody having to turn up for more than a couple of 3 days of work, a week doing socially creative endeavour. Volunteers working in conditions that we ourselves create for ourselves, that suit ourselves. So then we come on to, why are we in this situation? Well, as a class-divided society, we have masters and we have servants, workers and owners. Now, to be a worker, obviously, is to be a servant. And so we have to have a system that conditions servility, humility, into us. And that's carried out in the education system. I mean, I worked as a caretaker for the last 5.5 years of my employed life. And they all knew I was a commie, and I had lots of conversations with teachers. And I pointed out to lots of them that the way I saw it, the institution we were working at, had nothing to do with real education. It was about training, conditioning, programming the children to turn up on time, wear appropriate clothing, take their breaks on time, go home on time, and above all, do as they're told. So they could then go and sell themselves on the labour market and make a profit for an employer. That was the purpose of education. The thing is, they all agreed with me. So, this is it. So we're all social products. And the quality of any productive process determines the quality of the product. And what amazes me in this dog-eat-dog war of all-against-all society, capitalism, how well we behave, how we still retain our cooperativeness, our sociability under this immense pressure to do otherwise. And what's important, essentially, and what's denied us through our education, is the knowledge of who we are. Because it's like everything else. I mean, the more you know about what it is to, say, be a builder or a school caretaker, a doctor, a nurse, a scientist, a technician, the more of a doctor, a nurse, a scientist, etc., you can be. So what is it? What is it to be human? Well, if we have a look. I mean, the first thing what we've got to take notice of is our biology. And I mean, geneticists have it that, and it's a science, that we humans emerged out of nature a couple of hundred thousand years ago, Southeast Africa, Great Rift Valley. Well adapted, successful, and therefore we spread out. And in that spreading out, we become separated by purely the superficial, by skin colour, by language, by costume, all these things, purely superficial. But what they tell us is that we all share the same ancestors. So therefore, we're all members of the same human family. Now, if a family is to function as a family must, if it's a real family, the ethic is observed from each according to ability to each according to need. So if we look at this society with its massive amount of social dysfunction, and we also notice that this ethic is ignored, we can see where our problems are arising immediately. And this is something that I've developed. I think it's well worth knowing, is that to be a servant in our society, to be humbled, we have to lack self-esteem. And of course, that's our self-esteem is robbed from us, you know, by the society we live in. It's conditioned out of us. Well, I mean, as a builder, every day of the week when I started work of a morning, you'd look at the job and you'd make an estimate of how long it would take, materials, you know, the work involved. So what I did, I used that on myself, that process of estimation. And what I did, I used capitalism's method. Because in capitalism, anything, a commodity, and of course we as human beings, we supply a commodity to the market, which is labour power, we sell it on the market. Every commodity is priced, except this one, our one, every commodity is priced according, averaged out over the whole economy, to the amount of useful necessary labour embodied in its production. So a Rolls Royce costs more than a push bike, because there's more work embodied in the Rolls Royce. So using that method, capitalism method, I looked at myself and I thought, well, my mum and dad went out in society and worked long and hard to get me food, clothing, shelter, medicine, education, all the kinds of things that you need to grow up and become independent, become an independent human being. But then I realised that my parents didn't spring spontaneously out of nature. I had grandparents, and they worked long and hard, probably harder and longer, in worse conditions than my parents. And then, you know, then you can use them. I used my imagination and I went right back throughout my history to the early, to the earliest modern humans. And every generation of human beings that have led up to me have had to struggle, overcome, endeavour, love, nurture, discover, educate, all requiring effort, all requiring work. And like everybody else in this room and everybody else on the planet, all that work was embodied in me. And I was asked there then to go by capitalism, to go to the labour market and sell it for a pittance. When I looked at all that work, I realised that I was priceless, absolutely priceless. But capitalism demands I sell myself for a price. And of course, what that means is something special, something revealing, in that anything that's sold on a market for a price cannot be free. So as I see it, freedom is life without price, where we give voluntary, we give freely of our social creativity and therefore can take freely from social production. Right, well, I think I'm going to wind up now because I'm going on for a bit. So I'm going to refer back to a question a vicar asked all the candidates in the last general election at the church down opposite the Oval Station. And he asked us to describe our moral compass. I thought, because this was, you know, you got some forewarning of this. So I sat down and I thought about it. And when it was my turn to speak, I said, a compass is a very fine instrument because it gives you directions. I said, but what you really need is to find out where you are. And for that, you need a sextant. And I've got one. And I said, what we have, we have a society where we have a mass psychology, a way of thinking, a way of thinking that we all agree on, we all follow. And like every society there's ever been, every society there ever will be, you will need a particular worldview. Like there was the worldview of band hunter-gatherers based on what they knew about the world around them and themselves. Then you had the worldview of chattel slavery, feudalism, and now capitalism. And the worldview, the mass psychology we have now that we endure, if you like, is it's the mass psychology of market that has it that. And it's irrefutable, by the way, because it's out there. You cannot mistake it once you look at it. This worldview says that the more you have, the more you are. The more you've been able to take, the more you are. And it doesn't matter how you've managed to take it. You could be an armed robber, a drug dealer, people trafficker, a child pornographer. If you have the money in sufficient amounts, you can go to the market and your most frivolous whim can be satisfied in an instant. On the other hand, if you're in dire straits, your family, your friends, yourself are starving, you're in need of medicine, and you approach the market, which is the outlet of the goods and services to relieve your situation, with no money in your pocket, as far as the market's concerned, not only do your needs not exist, you don't exist. So we live in a society where not only the more you have, the more you are pertains, but the less you have, the less you are. And if you've no money, as far as our society, as far as the market's concerned, you are nobody. Now, as far as I'm concerned, we all carry the same amount of humanity. So knowing that, the question is, what direction do we want to travel? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Danny. Before we go on to discussion, questions and answers, we have a number of visitors here who probably haven't been here before, so I'd like to pass around a sort of naming list. If anybody wishes to, they can put their name and email address on it. Oliver, if you would kindly pass that around. And also,
don't forget the app.
The hat is this. I don't know why I've got two. You were expected to fill
it. Bigger meeting, I think it was expected a bigger meeting.
So also, you know, it costs us to maintain this head office, so if you'd like to make a contribution, although you're not obliged to, I'll pass that around as well.
Can you put literature money in that box, or is that separate? Is that
sure. Yeah, we can have that separate. Oh, yeah, have that separate. Yeah, thanks. So, anybody got any questions you want to ask Danny? Anybody want to just make any points? Go ahead.
So not all at once.
Yeah,
not all at once.
Yeah.
Pat?
Yes, just very good. When you listed the people who've got money, you picked all the illegal
If there's any misunderstanding, what I meant was that it doesn't matter. That's what I said. If you were a drug dealer, a child, etc., 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 the market money is anonymous.
Yeah.
So it doesn't. You know, the market doesn't care where you've got the money. You know, as long as you've got it, they'll satisfy your need. So let's make that one clear. Yeah, it's not just the crooks we're after. And that's another thing. You know, when I was talking about all the unnecessary labour, all the unnecessary time that our social creativity is absorbed by capitalism. There's also all the crime as well. Because, you know, when you live in a society where things are just free, you know, nobody can steal any, you know, there's just plenty for everybody because, you know, as I should have pointed out, is at the moment we're so busy taking care of business, we don't have time to take care of ourselves. And in a socialist society, a sane society, which is what it will be, then we will have the time and the resources to take care of ourselves.
Emma.
I'm a resident of Vauxhall. Given that the HOE's won that seat with huge cracking majorities since 1989, is a vote for you nearly futile?
What have I done?
No, it's a dumb question for you. You're a candidate.
I thought I was going to get a blow there. Well, I mean, we've got somewhere we've got a little flyer a little sticker that people are invited to stick on their ballot paper. Some people don't like it. I'm not too sure myself, but it's a quote from Eugene Debs, who said it's better to vote for something and not get it than for something you want. It's better to vote for something you want and not get it than to vote for something you don't want and get it. And of course, I mean, that's you go to the ballot box to vote for what you want, and if anybody is under the illusion that capitalism can be run in the interest of working people, then it's similar to being under the illusion that you can run an abattoir in the interest of the animals it processes. You know, capitalism doesn't work that way. I mean, capitalism just runs on our exploitation. I mean, the very word employment gives us a clue. Look at, I mean, it means to use, to exploit, to take advantage of. I think people should vote for what they want. I mean, because if people feel that they should vote for us, I mean, unless of course you're one of these people who think like the lesser of two evils, or put the other way around, the evil of two lessers, then you know, vote for what you really want, because. Give us a bit of encouragement as well. Every vote counts.
Make one comment. Some people may not know who Eugene Debs was. He was very prominent in the Labour movement in the States.
Yeah.
In the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah.
Was he a member of the Wibbly Wobblies? I can't remember that.
No, I think that was Daniel D. Leon Bill, was it? I mean, you might know.
Yeah.
No, Eugene Debs was an amazing chap. He actually stood for president and received a huge amount of votes, and he stood for president while he was in prison. They imprisoned him for opposing the First World War.
and being eloquent in his opposition. That was his crime.
Just thought I'd make a comment on the business of vote for us as opposed to vote for a winner. To a certain extent, if what you're doing is saying that if you don't vote for the elected candidate, then it's always a vote, what you're doing is sort of saying, in a sense, that voting democracy is a waste of time unless you back a winner. The predicate of the whole basis of the system is that what you're doing is that you are selecting something that you support rather than anything else. Otherwise, you have to say that every vote which doesn't go to the winning candidate is a wasted vote.
Yeah.
The premise of our system is hopefully at some point, what that will do is represent the views of enough people, but you can't have that be reflective of everybody's views. If what they're doing is they're saying, oh no, that person's going to win, so I've got to vote for them. Maybe part of the problem with our system is more people worrying about voting tactically rather than voting for what they believe in. and we advocate the Liberal
Party.
Does that help?
No, because I always spoil my ballot paper and scroll the class war across it anyway. frankly, no. But by the same token, it would be nice to have my scrawled class war messages registered as a vote of disapproval within the ballot results.
Yeah, I think you've got a little way to go here.
That's not a lot.
Yeah, Frank.
While looking, I also, for the last few years, have done a protest vote and wondered how, you know, how do they actually get counted and, you know, what kind of impact they do have. But while sort of looking on the internet, I came across a website called spoilyourvote.com or something like that, where they're actually encouraging people to spoil their votes. But it said something that at the moment there's 1% of people and 36% is needed in order for some sort of dissolution in, you know, Parliament and something to happen. So they're says it's a long way off. But then you've got people like Russell Brand encouraging people not to vote as well, which is, I think, totally wrong, because I agree with the ballot box system that it's, we know it's lack of choice, really.
I think when he says don't vote, is he actually saying precisely what's been said in this room? Don't vote for the organised.
Yeah, that's right.
I think he actually advocates spoiling ballot papers as well.
Right.
In fact, there was a thing in the Strike magazine with Natalie Bennett in the current issue. And the tagline, the byline is you must vote, and obviously the implication being that you would vote for any of the candidates, and when it got to the final paragraph she was explicitly saying you must go on to the polling station and make some gesture even if it's spoiling your paper. So I think it's gaining some sort of currency.
Danny?
Yeah, the vote is important. I mean, for a start, the working class struggled long and hard to have a say, and we have to respect that. And to be fair to Russell Brand, I heard him say, you know, don't vote, but if there's something like worth voting for, go and vote. For us socialists, we see socialism as synonymous with democracy. And it's essential that we should use this opportunity what I'm going to do on Thursday, I'm going to go on my polling station, and I'm going to write something revolutionary on the ballot paper. You know, I generally put www.worldsocialism.org. I might try something else. You know, see if that works. See if that brings us a revolution. But no, I think it's absolutely essential that we go and vote, even if we spoil our ballot paper, because what it does, it sends a message to those that seek our votes that we don't approve. And there was some talk recently about elections, and where like the people who didn't vote, I think Adam might have brought it up at some point, the people who didn't vote actually won the elections. You know, they were the majority. You know, they had a larger amount of vote than any one of the other candidates.
Bill?
Well, I think a lot of websites look at where we're not standing. We do advocate a spoiled ballot, and obviously Daniel again emphasised that he doesn't live in the constituency he's standing in. So that's why he's not voting for himself. I can say for certain that all spoiled ballots are inspected by the returning officer and candidates' agents, and so they do get seen. I was a bit alarmed to see one of our spoiled ballot leaflets stuck on a wall in the constituency I'm contesting, so I think I would be in that embarrassing situation of seeing one of our spoiled ballots fall in front of my eyes, and I can guarantee I will not try and pitch to have it added to my talk. That does happen. But there is an example of spoiled ballots actually having a significant effect, which is Argentina, where not only in a country where at the time voting I think was compulsory, so there was mass stayaways from the vote. A lot of people did turn up to spoil the ballot and brought the government down at the time. So it's not a futile waste of time to spoil your ballot paper. And it's not, essentially, in many ways, voting for us is a spoiled ballot paper, because we're not going to form a government, we're not going to enact any policies. We're sort of set up our own political picket line saying political life as normal can't continue. here is our single demand, deal with it.
But is it a big part of the problem then is that all the people that don't vote aren't spoiling their votes. That would be a step in the right direction, wouldn't it? If you've got all those people, you know, just who probably walk past the polling station on the day to spoil the vote.
Can we vote in another borough for another borough? Or is the voting done over London or just borough by borough? I mean, I can vote in my own borough to the MPs, those who are candidates in my own borough, or I can vote, for example, to you or anyone else.
No, you have...
The area for which you vote is called a constituency. It's the one in which you live, and that's determined by the Electoral Boundaries Commission. And all that happens is you can only vote for people that stand in that area.
Well, London is not one constituency.
No, London is about...
Well, this is not right, you know, because in this way, just big parties can give MPs to Parliament, not a small party. Because if the voting is done over all London or even all country, many from small parties get into Parliament. This voting system is undemocratic.
Yeah, no, most people would agree.
Some people here that we've got a quantity of ballot paper stickers for those who don't, those who live in a constituency where there isn't a candidate standing. So those stickers could be used. They could also be used in other locations by removing the top line of text. So we've got quite a few here if anybody wants to take any away.
Of course, only used in legal circumstances. I have a question.
Sure.
As we know that the political system, the voting system, the parliamentary system is run by the capitalist system, and mainly the government is formed by the capitalist. So doesn't it contradict when a socialist is standing up for voting in their club, when he's standing for MP to joining in their greater clubs, doesn't it contradict the socialist principles?
No, not at all. What you have to, an essential thing to know, what a BBC have got, the essential thing to know is where the real power in society lies. And it's not with the capitalist class at all. The real power in our society lies with the workers, because it's we workers who do every ounce of work that reproduces our society day to day. Now, when we, as a majority, decide that we want to make other arrangements the way we live, then there's no power on earth that can stop us. That's it. And, of course, the other thing is that it's democratic. And as a builder, I know that if you want to build a beautiful, robust structure, you've got to use robust materials and build beautifully. So, therefore, if you want to build a democratic society, create a democratic society, that society, like if you want to have the ends to equal, the means to equal the end, that society has to be created democratically. And of course, that's it. You see, Marx said that the vote was the most powerful weapon the working class has, and that was echoed by Engels. And you see, the thing about capitalism is it recognises where the power lies. And so therefore, it has to have elections. And the sole purpose of these elections is to have capitalism, the system, legitimised by us workers voting for capitalist-supporting parties. That's it. Now, the great thing about doing it this way, the way we propose, is they can't touch us for it. We're playing by their rules. And, of course, if they do try and an obstruct us, or in whatever way they do, when we've reached that point where we become troublesome, there's going to be a lot of us, and if they start screwing with us in any way they choose, then it's going to be noticed, and they're going to lose this legitimacy. And that's the only thing, the legitimacy we would give them is the only thing that allows them to carry on doing as they do. So in a sense, you can say they're buggered if they do and buggered if they don't. And, you know, and I mean, it's the only way. And of course, I mean, we're not like the left, in that, you know, we don't see like barricades or, you know, confrontations or anything like that. We want to do it peacefully, because if you want to live in a peaceful society, that society has to be created peacefully. It's means and ends, you know, the unity of means and ends. An honest society has to be created, honestly, and because democracy is the best way to go about it. And they can't touch us for us. And it's, we have the power. We have the power. Once we democratically express that as a majority, game's over. Different world.
There are two things Marshall said at the beginning of Capital Volume 1, as said, in bourgeois democracy, we get into public and, at least I said, we resort to taking part in elections, in bourgeois democracy. And in, against dictatorship, we should get arms. Therefore, in this country, we have the chance of advertising for socialism. That's why we are getting into parliament. We don't mean to get into ministerial position with the parties of capitalism when they are majority. This is what Marx, what you said, Marx has prohibited. Getting into a ministerial position when the majority is with parties of capitalism. Otherwise, Marx has said in bourgeois democracy, we can take part in parliament. At the beginning of the war of capital, we can consider.
Can I try and phrase it in a different way? Which is that the purpose of standing in these elections isn't to join that club. Yeah. What you did was you said, if you're elected, then you join the capitalist club, as it were, you know, the running things. But our purpose isn't to be elected and therefore become members of that club and, as it were, collaborate with them. Ours is to turn around and say, actually, let's create a different club that everyone's a member of. Okay, so what we're not seeking to emulate what's happening at the moment or participate in that. We're standing in order to turn around and say, actually, we can do things totally differently. It needn't be done like this. And what it is the ballot box is a means of, A, getting our message across, the kind of things that were being spoken about earlier on, in terms of consciousness raising. Okay, so getting the message across. But B, it allows a means by which popular support for our position can be demonstrated. Okay, and what you're doing is you're building up gradually popular support. With enough popular support, you can turn around and say, actually, not that way of doing things, a different way of doing things. And so what you're doing is you're using their methods to undermine their system. Yeah, does that help?
Yeah, that's what it did.
Thank you very much. There's something I might have said in my talk, I think it's quite important. I might just run through it again and give you some idea why we feel that the democracy is so important. In that we're all products of history, and history can be seen in all kinds of ways. You know, it's a historical record of all that's happened to us, all that's been done, who did, and the reasons for doing. And we can also see history as the more we know, the more we can do, the better we know, the better we can do. But there's kind of a philosophical way of looking at history, looking at it as a rite of passage, a coming of age. Now, when a human being finishes, you know, completes their rite of passage and comes of age, they become an adult. And as an adult, they should have a fair idea of who they are, what they want, and how to get it. But there's a qualification that is gained when you become an adult, and that is you're qualified to take care of children, young infants, the new humans. Because they're in no position to take responsibility for themselves, let alone you. So if we look at our world today and see the plight that the young humans on this planet, these children, are in, we can immediately see that our society has yet to complete its historical rite of passage and come of age. And there's something else that an adult should be aware of and acknowledge when they become aware of. And it's the kind of unbreakable law of social responsibility that states unequivocally is that the only way to deal with social responsibility responsibly is to share it. Not give it over to politicians to exercise for you. Not to claim that you can exercise other people's. That's all irresponsible. The only responsible way to deal with social responsibility is to share it. That's why we're so in favour of democracy. And we'll take advantage of every democratic avenue that there is at our disposal to actually bring about a society where that social law, that social law of responsibility can be acknowledged.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
What Teletensky did in what we say is right about what Teletensky did in this. They took part with parties of capitalism like Labour and Tory in government. This is a bad thing that you mentioned. But we can take part in a ministerial, in parliament and in ministerial position. We can take part with anarchists that are petty bourgeois, but if they believe in democracy, leftists, we can call them. Or left-wing Leninists, if they don't support Labour Party elections and are not revisionists. We can take part in a ministerial position as well, I think. Therefore, they can be called leftists. These are parties, they are parties of capitalism as well, anarchists and left-wing Leninists. I think anarchists and left-wing Leninists are the two sides of the same coin. They think that they are petty bourgeois, radical parties, leftist parties, if they believe in democracy. But we can't make a cabinet out of ourselves and them, but not with Labour or Tory and other reactionary parties.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I understood all of what you said, but I don't think the Socialist Party would be in a position to collaborate with anybody other than, you know, we're a Socialist Party. We stand for socialism and nothing else. And we are, I mean, I don't think there's anybody in this, any member of the party who foresees a cabinet position for anybody. I mean...
Ruined my weekend.
Oh, no, you're one of those. Our aim is democracy, you know, pure and simple. And you know, we have no intention of governing anybody. I mean, what we want is that we want to replace the governance of human beings to the administration of things. We want a society, a classless society, but it's a common interest where people realise that an injury to one is an injury to all. And that, you know, we're much better off cooperating than we are competing, you know. And we feel that honesty is the best policy, the truth sets you free, all these what people consider like trite little cliches, but you know, there's weight in them.
Ethical slogan. Ethical.
Yeah.
When we want a practical solution for capitalism instead of ethical slogans about being good and or bad.
No, that's you're mistaking ethical for moral.
Now, is it possible, as we know, that all over the country there are so many people do not vote because they don't like the political system?
Yeah.
They don't like the capitalism or the system of the governance in this country. Many people do not vote. Now, these votes are wasted, as we know. But if the Socialist Party, put candidates all over the country, and these people will vote them, and if they don't vote, then because it is impossible to put candidates all over the place right now, but in the future, if the party nominate candidates everywhere, then every people will have access to vote.
Yeah.
Because these people simply do not like voting because they think this governing voting system is wrong.
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is if we used to have candidates everywhere,
yeah,
we had a position, you know, I mean, we have to stretch our imaginations at the moment to think that, then what we would be doing, we'd be putting forward information. We'd have the resources to put forward information. So therefore, the people will be understanding what was on offer, and if they was in favour of what was on offer, then they come and vote for us. But it's not just voting for us. We don't want people to vote for us. I mean, it's nice, but we want people to come and help. And essentially, what we're doing at the moment, I mean, Marx talks about in his chapter, I think it's in Capital, on the commodities, and he talks about the enchantment of commodity society. Our workers are enchanted by it. You know, you could use the term hypnotised or mesmerised. And that's a fact. I mean, people are. I mean, you've only got to look at people. You talk to people sometimes, and you're telling them about, you know, the analysis and the proposition of socialism. It seems to be going right over there, and they don't take anything in. And you know, they don't ask any questions, and they go, oh, yeah, and then they're off again. What we need is to get as many people around us as possible. You know, we want members so that we can make as much noise as we possibly can and start waking people up, you know, clicking our fingers, you know, with more volume, saying, you know, you're come on, you're back in the room. This is the real world. not the world you've been taught to imagine by the television, you know, and the advertisers. So this, so we're not, we, I mean, essentially, we're not after, well, we're, I mean, we're, the nicest people vote for us, but what we want, really, when we do these, we do these campaigns, is members, socialists, because you can't have socialism without socialists. Well, I hope that goes some way to answer your question. I think I'm sitting all gone off a bit of a rant here, but...
Can I go home now? Yeah. Anybody else?
Just to sort of emphasise on that, that it's not just a question of voting, as you said, people, we can't give them socialism, however active their voting is. It's got to be the people themselves organising, because they going, the people who do the work now are going to organise what happens in socialism. So it's not a passive vote, not choosing, you know, someone to do something for them. It's choosing, we're voting now for socialism because we are going to be organising society and we are going to be
exactly
the ones, you know...
As I said, like, the only way to deal with social responsibility is to share it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we can stop now, break now, and go upstairs and continue the discussion over tea and biscuits and cake. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank Danny Lambert.
I'd like to thank you for all turning up. Cheers.